From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, The Awakened Psychic. And at the end of the show, the tribute to the Edmund Fitzgerald. It sank in Lake Superior, claiming 29 lives 41 years ago. Gosh, doesn't seem that long. Here's what's happening. For the second day in a row, thousands of protesters took to the streets across the country Thursday night, even as President-elect Donald Trump and President Barack Obama sought to set an example by striking a more conciliatory tone in their first meeting since the election. Protesters in San Francisco, including students from at least 10 schools, demonstrated by marching in the city's downtown area, chanting, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, Donald Trump has got to go." For the second day in a row, New Yorkers took to the streets in droves, asking the country to join them. Demonstrations have taken place in at least 10 cities, with more adding to the mix. Anti-Trump protests in Miami, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Dallas, Louisville, Kentucky. Expected more this week. And for the most part, demonstrators have been peaceful, but the arrests have been made in California and in Chicago as well. Now, the U.S. banking sector shares surged to levels not seen since the midst of the 2008 financial crisis, pushing the Dow to an all-time high, while technology shares sank as the Wall Street rearranged its bets to benefit from Donald Trump's presidency. Ms. Shedlock with us. Michael, what do you think this presidency will do for the stock market?
Well, what has he said, George, and what is he going to do? The Dow futures were off 1,000 points, and in a matter of hours, they recovered all of it and more.
Yeah.
S&P, the Nikkei was down 1,300 points.
That's 5%. The Japanese market.
Yes, the Japanese market. It recovered all of it. You know, the gold was up and then down and then up and now down. Meanwhile, oil, which is what I'm really looking at, as an indication of what the economy is going to do, just kind of sat there flat. So people are shrugging their shoulders. Now, Trump did promise that he's going to put something on infrastructure, and I actually think that's going to happen. We can debate whether or not that's a good idea or not. Personally, I think deficits are a bad idea, but it's probably going to happen. Why? Because Republican congressmen and Democratic congressmen are going to say, "Hey, he wants to spend money in my district. Let's do it." Meanwhile, stuff like the wall, I still don't think the wall is going to happen, George. I think the wall is a very bad idea. And I don't think he can do that by himself. So we've got this dichotomy here of things that might happen and might not. But he was very, very conciliatory.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Amazing. He sounded presidential after he won. Meanwhile, Germany came out, and Angela Merkel, Chancellor Merkel, came out and practically threatened Trump and said, "You know what? You know, don't go through with this global warming revisions. Don't do this. Don't do that." Meanwhile, she's in bed with Turkey. And the president of Turkey is issued a post. He said women don't belong, are not equal to men, and you know they don't have rights that men do. So it's all very, very confusing here, George. But here's the final analysis on this. If Trump goes ahead with his plan to put tariffs on Chinese goods, we're going to see inflation in the U.S. We're going to see prices rise. If the Fed reacts to that, they will be reacting to a false economy signal.
And you know what will happen to the stock market if the Fed raises interest rates.
Yes. Well, we believe we know what will happen. And I mean, so many things that people thought they knew didn't happen. We thought, you know, everyone thought that they knew that the Brexit was a bad idea. Actually, I thought Brexit was a good idea. I wasn't surprised by that at all. I was not all that surprised by a Trump victory. I thought he was going to lose after he totally blew the first debate. Then the polls started swinging around in his favor. I was no longer surprised. So what is he going to do here? That's the key. I think short-term the market is reacting, actually, to this deficit spending with more on infrastructure, and we have to see, does he follow through on his trade threats? Because my big fear, George, still remains, as we discussed many times before, is a global trade war, and no one wins them.
We will see. Mish, thank you. City lawmakers in Los Angeles have approved a nighttime ban on living in vehicles near homes, parks, and schools over the protests of those who say the measure will criminalize homeless people. The LA Times reports that the measure permits parking and sleeping in certain industrial or commercial districts. The ordinance cites unsanitary conditions, noise, and crime as reasons for the ban in other parts of the city. If you go up to coasttocoastam.com, look at the highlights video. A man in China who has gone without his right ear for the past year will soon have a new appendage after doctors grew the body part of his arm using part of his rib cage. So he's going to have an ear because it was grown on part of his arm, and then they'll just attach it. And it's his, so there's not going to be any rejection. Two brothers from Slovakia have won a grave-digging competition at an international exhibition of funeral, burial, and cremation services. The two brothers, 43 and 41 years old, dug a grave 1.5 meters deep, 2 meters long, 90 centimeters wide in 54 minutes to win. How about that? A strangely shaped depression on Mars could be a new place to look for signs of life on the red planet. According to a University of Texas at Austin study, the depression was probably formed by a volcano beneath a glacier and could have been a warm, chemical-rich environment well-suited for microbial life. What else is going on in the skies? And, of course, we've got the supermoon coming up on Monday, but here's Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. Stephen.
Hi, George. Oh, great stuff here. I'm sitting here watching the moon right now, like I'm sure many Coast listeners, because the countdown to the supermoon, as we've been building up, and so much of the media, George, you look all over the web and TV and radio is talking about this. Again, the best time to see it, you want to look on Monday, just as the moon does rise. Check the local times for moonrise. But as you move into the weekend, there's still great opportunities to see it. So if we look right now at the moon, for those that can see our live sky, the moon now is some 226,000 miles away. The moon only has to go two times its actual diameter. It's about 2,159 miles across the moon's diameter. So, George, move it two times its diameter closer, and that's how close it will be, 221,524 miles when you see it. And what's really cool about this is if you look into some really interesting facts about the moon, and I was amazed at this one, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has a lot of its headquarters out here at Arizona State University, back in 2009, they came up with this amazing measurement of temperature, and they said this: the lowest temperature observed in the solar system is not out by Neptune and Pluto, it's at the south pole of the moon, some 397 degrees below zero on the Fahrenheit scale. That's not quite to absolute zero, but the point of the whole thing is, if you're staring at the moon, looking at the southern part of the moon, another good reason to say, wow, an amazing little object. And George, even more amazing is, why do we have these perfect total eclipses of the sun? The diameter of the moon and the sun match is so amazing. And finally, here's something really cool. In the live sky, we're going through two small meteor showers, one that peaks right now called the Northern Torrids. Look to the left of the moon for the next few nights, and if you see a few of these bright, blazing fireballs, there are a few of them, not many, you're seeing something from Encke's Comet, this, of course, known as the Northern Torrids. George, so much. Don't forget, everybody, take a look at that supermoon over the weekend, Monday night. And Dr. Sky reminds everyone, always remember to keep your eyes to the sky.
Yeah, that's going to be an exciting moment, indeed. In a moment, one of the world's greatest Egyptologists, John Anthony West, joins me. His latest work, Dead Saints Chronicles. John Anthony West, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Award-winning Egyptologist and writer John Anthony West has been in the front line battles to rewrite all of ancient history, and with a little change of our future, of course. New discoveries in his closely related fields gives him reason to believe that the tide may soon turn in the direction he's been working on. Number of works out there, his most recent, Dead Saints Chronicles. Always welcome John Anthony West to Coast to Coast. Hello there, John. How are you?
Hello, George Norrie. I am just fine.
Looking forward to this. You are one of our favorites and one of the giants of Egyptology, my friend.
Well, I'm a small giant.
Hey, what's the latest with Zahi Hawass? Where is he now?
Well, Zahi is actually not exactly under the radar. He is unofficially, I mean, he is no longer officially the Minister of
Antiquities,
which is a cabinet position. But he's functioning very busily as a kind of ambassador without portfolio, largely looking to somehow or another light a fire under tourism, which has been pretty much at a standstill since the revolution of,
that's right,
of 2011. And, you know, I run trips to Egypt all the time. I was there for the revolution. And this, I mean, an empty Egypt is wonderful for us when we're there to be able to avoid the crowd.
That's right.
But it's horrendous for the poor Egyptians. I mean, this is a poor country with no safety nets or anything of the sort. And probably 20% of the populace were making livings, even little livings, out of tourism. And now they're absolutely out of luck. And the whole thing is completely unnecessary and largely a result of our mainstream media and the media prostitutes who make Egypt sound as though it's Syria. And it isn't Syria. Things go on. But anybody who comes from America, arguably one of the most dangerous places on earth in terms of the sheer mass of people who get gunned down for no reason whatsoever, is lunacy. I mean, it's fine. I lead trips there all the time.
Well, that's good. Now, do you stay in touch with him? He escaped jail, didn't he, during that scourge?
Well, they couldn't pin anything on him. Now, whether or not he has lots of enemies, so my guess is that if there was anything really that they could have pinned on him, they would have done so, and he got off scot-free and is wandering around, and buried the hatchet with him.
Oh, good.
Years ago. It's a long story, but which I won't go into.
Now, Bovall hasn't. They still don't like
each
other.
Bovall is very foolish in that, because there's no reason for him to have baited Zahi, whatever he may feel personally. Bovall prides himself on being, in his words, a slippery eel when it comes to negotiations and all of that sort of thing. But it's exactly the contrary with Zahi. He's unnecessarily made a bitter enemy, and Zahi is not a good guy to have as an enemy.
No, he isn't.
We'll see how that falls out, but that's not my concern.
Well, with John Anthony West, and John, you didn't start off as an Egyptologist, did you?
No, I did not.
How did you get involved in this?
Ah, well, that's a long story, too, and we only have 2 hours.
Ah.
Anyhow, put it this way, at a very early age, I was not a child prodigy, I was a bright little kid, but I was, I like to think, psychologically precocious, and I knew at the age of 12 or 13 that I'd been born into a lunatic asylum. By the time I was 19, I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to be the little boy who says the emperor has no clothes. And my chosen medium for that was writing. Nothing to do with scholarship, just writings and mainly satire. And that's what I started doing. And, you know, got published fairly young and had a number of things done, never made any money to speak of, but a novel and a book of short stories and a bunch of plays. And I was living at that time when my first short story was published, which was 1957. I was wildly in love with a woman who wouldn't have me, thank God, otherwise I'd have stayed. And took off, found my way to the then magical island of Ibiza, and was living there. And again, more long story, but got interested first through a very good friend of mine, an excellent Dutch novelist, a generation older than myself, in astrology, and that led me by a series of strange fits and starts and so-called coincidences to the work of G.I. Gurdjieff. And that really interested me because Gurdjieff was the first person I'd ever encountered, albeit posthumously, he died in 49, who was as contemptuous of Western civilization as I was. The difference was that he knew how to live in it, and I didn't anyway, not very well. And I got involved with the Gurdjieff work, and at a certain point after 9 years in Ibiza, moved to England, where I could join one of the schools associated with his ideas.
Yeah.
And there, also by weird coincidence, had a novel published and got friendly with my editor, who was a Cambridge-trained mathematician turned editor because he couldn't make a living out of mathematics. And we were having a jar in a pub one day, and subject of astrology came up, and he said, "Oh, that's a bunch of codswallop, isn't it?" And I said, "Well, no, as a matter of fact, it isn't. It's a subject I know rather a lot about. I've studied it, and I tell you that there's a certain amount of evidence, some of it direct, more of it indirect, and if you put it all together, you'd have a case for astrology." And that interested him, and he said, "Would you bring me in documentation?" Which I did. And he said, "Well," he said, "I'm not necessarily 100% convinced, but would you do a book on this?" And I said, "Well, yeah, my standard answer to something like that is, pay me some money, I'll do a book on anything." That's not actually quite true, but it's not a bad look.
No, it's not a bad opening, that's true.
And so all of a sudden, the case for astrology was born. And in doing the research into the history of astrology, which I was convinced was not a Babylonian superstition made rational or rationalized by the Greeks, that it was much, much older than that and was part of an ancient sacred science, I ran across the work. Somebody in my Gurdjieff group suggested I read a book called Herbach, a two-volume novel by a woman named Isha Schwalla de Lubix. And I got that book. It was translated into English from the French. And it was a horrible novel, but actually it painted a picture of Egypt that corresponded to what Gurdjieff said in his very strange and daunting main book, or first book, called All and Everything, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. And it corresponded to that, and that got me really interested. And I eventually, having finished Herbach, went to the London, the British Museum, and had a ticket to the library. You could get that if you're a published author, and found they had a copy of Schwalla's own book, which had not been translated from the French, and I spoke barely beginner's French, but I kind of riffled through the pages, and, you know, I was a pro already. I had a lot of things published. I was struck immediately by the fact that he had done something of immense importance, which was to reconfigure or reformulate, a better word, reformulate the sacred science of the ancients. And it was that was responsible for Egypt itself and for all the miraculous art and architecture that we find there. If you listen to the quackademics who are in charge of our education, they will tell you that Egypt was real, that civilization, in our sense, really started with the Greeks, and Egypt was a sort of an aberration, yeah, of a bunch of primitives who were nevertheless geniuses, architectural geniuses, architectural and artistic geniuses, which is a contradiction in terms. Primitives do not produce architectural magnitude.
No, especially of the scope and magnitude that we see
exactly
now. My God.
Anyway, so one thing led to another, and I sort of down tools. I was working on the astrology book, and just made my, I couldn't find a copy of the book myself anywhere. No, not in France, no place. So I had to go to the library. I lived all the way across London every day with a dictionary by my side, kind of learning French as I went through this daunting book, which is now published and now translated, and actually a brilliant translation called The Temple of Man. And at the end of that, I knew enough about what both adherents and critics called the symbolist interpretation of Egypt.
Hold on, John. We're going to hit this break, and we'll come back and talk more about Egypt. Got to get into your theories about the Great Sphinx, because you're the one that redated it, and I think everybody now agrees with you. We'll be back. With our special guest, John Anthony West, his latest work, Dead Saints Chronicles. We'll get into all his work in Egypt, the Sphinx. Fascinating, fascinating, fascinating. And welcome back to Coast with John Anthony West. So, John, once you got into the work in Egypt, you jumped in a big way, didn't you?
Well, initially, not such a big way. My first book, which was an in-depth introduction to Charlotte de Lubitz's symbolist interpretation, felt like a needle in a whirlpool when it first came out, but it had in it the seeds for what would subsequently become something of a big deal in terms of both scholarship and public interest. And that was a single line by Schwaller in one of his ancillary books, not his major work, though it's called The Temple of Man, but one that was called the King of the Pharaonic Theocracy. And in it, Schwaller was looking into the Egyptian belief, I would say understanding, actually, that their own civilization stretched back many, many thousands of years earlier, back into the past, which was actually, once you get it deep into it, it was a given. It was part of the legends and traditions of any number of societies, both sophisticated and less sophisticated around the globe. But Schwaller was looking into, actually it was old documents of Greco-Roman times around the centuries just before and just after Jesus and Caesar, of the writers talking about Egypt and the belief of the still existing Egyptian priesthood, that the civilization was much, much older. And so Schwaller put together a big scholarly a compendium of these various writings, many of them fragmentary, and at the very end came out with just a single line that says, and of course, the Great Sphinx of Giza shows unmistakable signs of aquatic erosion. When I read that,
bingo.
Well, I mean, Schwaller himself didn't seem to have realized that he'd hit the key to establishing the reality of this vanished, lost and highly sophisticated civilization. But I realized that Charlotte died about a year after he wrote that book. But it was just clear to me, had he realized himself how important that observation was, he'd have dwelled upon it, he'd have looked into it, but he didn't. So I did. and I recognized it for what it potentially was. And this was, you have to understand that this is not just a question of how old Egyptian civilization was, or any civilization, actually. What's the difference? What matters is the level of sophistication.
That's right.
That a civilization possesses.
And to have that kind of sophistication, John, even older than most people had thought, is remarkable, isn't it?
Well, yes, but it's real significance, particularly in an age that we see what, I mean, I don't call it civilization to begin with, but I have another name for it, but I don't know if I can say it on
the air. No, don't say it on the air.
Okay, I was wondering.
If you're in doubt, don't do it.
I was wondering how linguistically correct I would have to be. But anyway.
Just think of this as a family show.
Well, my family wouldn't mind. Anyway, we see this coming, coming and unstuck in front of our eyes. I mean, this latest farce of an election, basically the country got what it deserved, and if they had voted otherwise, it would still have got what it deserved, as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, with the Sphinx, this is the most, by common agreement, I think, the most spectacular sculpture on Earth, and perhaps even more to the point, I mean, when you see it for the first time, particularly if you see it alone and you're down in the enclosure where it's cut, is really it's a kind of an epiphany. You can't miss it. And
is it emotional when you first see it?
Very much so. Absolutely emotional. I mean, when I first went in there, having done a ton of work in the library, and we got in there, and I don't remember. I think I bribed my way in there because it wasn't open to the public, and still isn't. You know, but now you can get special permission and get in there. We do that on my trips. Anyway, it's deeply emotional, but perhaps even more impressive are the temples directly in front of it and adjacent to it, which don't look that spectacular when you just look at them. I mean, they're not gigantic like temples in later Egyptian temples, but they're sort of fortress-like looking, and they're built of stones that weigh upwards 50, 75, 100, even 150 tons.
Jeez.
Slotted into place like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. And it's how they did it is a total mystery, as usual, unaddressed by the quackademic community. And it should be addressed by all of them.
Oh my God, yeah. I mean,
they don't question it. Well, it's built when the Egyptians built everything else around 2500 BC. And, well, they just did it. And
I don't think 100,000 Egyptians pulled ropes to do it either.
Well, something like that. Anyway, the point is that we couldn't do that today when we did our big show, the one that won the Emmy, Mystery of the Sphinx, hosted by Charlton Heston.
Great show, by the way.
It went well, still does. And we went to the a place where they were building a cogeneration plant in Long Island, and they were moving into place a 200-ton boiler, and we interviewed the project manager, and that's in the show, about whether or not we could recreate the Sphinx temples today with the equipment that we now have, and he looked at it and he was pretty much astounded. And he said that, you know, in his trade, they were very interested in how ancient peoples moved around these tremendous stones that we have trouble moving today.
Mm-hmm.
And his conclusion was that, well, they had a crane that could lift these stones, but he didn't know or see how they could rig them in order to put them into the positions that they were in. In other words, without getting into the details, we couldn't do now what they did then.
That's right.
And
what does that tell you, John, about what does that tell you about the technology that they had, or something?
Well, it tells you that they had something, and something so sophisticated that we don't have it today. And let's face it, with all of the garbage that we have floating around us, with the worldwide pollution and the atom bombs and the hydrogen bombs and the bobblehead dolls and the stupid entertainment, I mean, this is a madhouse, as I correctly recognized 70 years ago when I was, well, what was I?
Do you rule out some probabilities, like, you know, some people believe extraterrestrials intervened and helped?
Well, I don't rule it out. But
you don't.
The point is, I don't rule it out. The point is that there is no evidence for it, none, not any. And it's no argument to say that, well, we can't do it now, so how could we have done it then?
Right.
It's got to be aliens. No, I reject that completely. I think it is people sort of like ourselves, but not as degenerate, in possession of some form of conscious awareness that allowed them to do what looks impossible to us.
See, I think what they did, this is just me now, that they used some kind of sound resonance and kind of floated these blocks into place.
Well, this could be. I mean, we can float with sound pea-sized blocks, but a pea-sized block is not a 75 or 100-ton block. So, you know, there are limits to what certain technologies can achieve. So we don't know. I mean, my best guess is we don't know what it is. My conviction is, or semi-conviction, let's say, until proved otherwise, that it's done by people like ourselves, but in possession of faculties, probably in the region of consciousness, in control of higher levels of consciousness that allowed them to move things around that we couldn't move. And in fact, there is evidence that we do have those capacities, but usually under emergency conditions. There are instances of a woman whose, you know, kid gets run over by a car, and she picks up the car and moves it off the kid. She couldn't do that 2 seconds before, and she can't do it 2 seconds afterwards. But when the emergency occurs, we have those kinds of ability. Martial arts masters at very high levels can do things that look impossible. So I think that in a far more civilized age, and sort of like the Hindu doctrine of the yugas comes in, where roughly like seasons, you know, there is a golden age and a silver age and a bronze age and an iron age. And what is easy in a golden age, let's say the equivalent of June, if you want to grow roses in June, it's easy. This stuff pops out of the ground. But if you want to grow roses in January, you have to go through a tremendous amount of trouble just to get roses to grow at all.
That's
all
right.
Kinds of special equipment. Something of that nature, that we are, in fact, with our Church of Progress, because that's the only religion that's really functioning today, these people believe that we're the most advanced beings that ever lived. And one of the extraordinary lessons of Egypt, and this is one of the reasons why I do my trips, we'll get to this in a second, is to prove to people what a real civilization once looked like, and at least in principle, could be reinstituted in our day or in our age.
Well, and here's a question that I've always been baffled. Assuming they had this kind of know-how, knowledge, technology 10, 15, 20,000 years ago, what happened to them? Why did it just seem to stop?
Why does summer turn into winter? This is the doctrine, Hindu mostly, but Plato had it as well. The doctrine of the yugas, that there's a time and a place for everything, and there are ages that are just conducive to higher levels of consciousness, and ages when acquiring even a little bit of that consciousness is a lifetime of effort. We're in such a stage now that it's the Kali Yuga.
Sure, but I mean, but we have a chronology of things. I mean, there's you know, a moment where we know what happened 200 years ago and 100 years ago.
Yeah.
In with the Egyptians, I mean, it's like everything they did to build the Sphinx, to build the pyramids, just fell off the planet. Gone.
Well, not quite. In other words, it's a civilization that in its recognized form, forgetting about the much older lost civilization, that existed in recognizable form for 3,500 years. I mean, that's a lot. That's half again the time from Jesus or Julius Caesar to us. And it was recognizable up to the very end. And even then it didn't disappear, because it when the Romans took over, it sort of disintegrated, but into its constituent parts. So these filtered down through Coptic Christianity and then through Islam and then into Christendom as the Hermetic arts. I mean, it was these subjects, astrology, magic, number symbolism, Neoplatonism, a whole bunch of such subjects that actually intrigued the masters of the Renaissance, who were not interested. They're always credited with the beginnings of our rational materialist science, but that's not really true. They were much more interested in these now heretical subjects, astrology, etc., than they were in starting off what would become our materialist and rationalist science. Newton spent, who is really, you might say, the founder of contemporary science, nevertheless, spent much more time studying biblical numerology than he devoted to what subsequently became our science. So they didn't really die out. And when de Lubitsch came along, this is 1900s, he was deeply schooled in what are called the Hermetic disciplines, the Hermetic And he was, in fact, a practicing alchemist, and succeeded, it's thought, and I think he did, in recreating the magical stained glass that they have in the Gothic cathedrals, and that's a secret that got lost. It was there when they were building Notre Dame and Chartres in the 14th centuries, and then it disappeared. The stained glass that you see in more modern churches is not what they have at Chartres, which is the best of them, because it's all complete. So it didn't really disappear, but it certainly disintegrated, and so did the entire civilization disappeared. But as I said, this, according to the Hindus and Plato, this is part of the natural process, and what goes around comes around, and we're now... It's a big argument among people, many of them my own colleagues, a big argument about where we stand in this preordained cycle. That we're, as far as I'm concerned, my personal belief is that we're deep in the middle of the Kali Yuga, which is the Dark Age. We have our quite brilliant, but largely amoral, and more to the point, immoral technology, which given it the opportunity, will do any damn thing, no matter what the consequences, even when the consequences are perfectly predictable. And at the same time, we have, from a spiritual point of view, we're about as depraved and as any civilization that we know of in history. Just look at the stuff that's going on.
Oh, my God, it doesn't stop. Next hour, I want to talk about your book, Dead Saints Chronicles. We'll take calls as well. But Edgar Cayce, I've been a student of Edgar Cayce for years, and he pointed out that there were three spots where the Hall of Records were located. One of them, he said, at the base of the Sphinx. And I'm pretty sure I remember years ago interviewing one of your colleagues, Robert Schock, who said that they found some kind of tomb or structure near the base of the Sphinx underground. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, very well. It's not a tomb. It's not a structure. It's a cavity. We think, and the seismograph, Edgar Cayce channeled his readings. Our seismograph does not know how to channel, and it said... And there are very good reasons to believe that there is such a chamber, more or less where Cayce said it was.
That's amazing.
Well, yeah. But it's since the Sphinx, no week goes by where somebody isn't writing me saying, hey, when are they going to excavate under the Sphinx?
Might they have excavated it and not
no.
Told us?
No.
Okay.
It's right in front of your nose. They couldn't possibly.
They couldn't do that. Okay. So why are they holding back, John? Why aren't they going down there?
There are some of it is they don't want egg on their faces. They don't want to pull. I don't know how old you are, George, but I don't know if you remember the what's his name, Rivera.
Geraldo Rivera. When they found Al Capone's stuff, right?
That's right. They don't want a Rivera moment of digging down in there and finding nothing whatsoever. The other is actually pretty practical. The water level's been rising over the last few thousand years, so that cavity or whatever it is, if it is man-made, would be filled with water. Pumping the water out would require building a cofferdam. It would be a lot of, not just expensive, but maybe dangerous technology, because the Sphinx really is in terrible shape.
Yeah, let's talk more about that. We're going to take this quick break. John Anthony West with us. His latest work, we'll get into Dead Saints Chronicles. We'll take some calls as well. Just, I love this stuff.